Good evening. Welcome to the Celeria Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. Tonight is October 17th, and this is the third quarter 2019 wrap-up equity overview. I'm glad you could join me this evening. Subscriber links. We have a fair amount of links for you this evening, and I've pulled out what I think are the most useful pieces to help you understand the key points I want to make about the global equity markets. The first is, of course, we have our web presentation for the third quarter 2019 wrap-up. We have both financial charts and the Rambus chartology up there. The Rambus chartology is particularly good this quarter. They're always great. Rambus does outstanding technical analysis on both the U.S. and global stock markets. Some real breakdown and look inside the markets. If you're trading the markets and use technical analysis, I strongly recommend a subscription to Rambus. I'm very appreciative that he allows us to publish his quarterly sort of deep dives on different aspects of the market. This quarter, he focuses again on the global stock markets and precious metals. The second link is Jeffrey Gundlach's Just Markets, which was his annual overview for Double Line. It's at the Double Line website, and it's an excellent overview of the challenges ahead in financing the U.S. government, as well as the coming squeeze in the corporate bond market. And he really shows you how the U.S. debt is spiraling up. And I've recommended that one to you before, but it really gives you an overview, which is important if you're going to look at global markets. Then there are two pieces from The Economist on the growing problem of large monopolies in the United States and its impact on slowing productivity. The first is called The Next Capitalist Revolution, and it was the overview of a bigger piece called An Age of Giants. Across the West, powerful firms are becoming even more powerful. And they really ring the bell on monopolistic developments and the cost to productivity. And then I have a link for the GMO second quarter 2019 quarterly letter entitled Bigger Has Been Better. GMO is Jeremy Grantham's firm, and I've quoted him before on the increased problems of monopolies developing in the U.S. market and what the harm it can do to productivity. And then finally, an old favorite, Global Stock Market Valuations and Expected Future Returns. It's an article that updates regularly, and it really shows you if growth in the markets is based on GDP and markets return to historical means, what kind of returns will be produced. And it gives you a very long-term perspective on the markets. Again, these materials are going to help you understand the key points I want to make tonight. Okay, 10 key points. Number one, we are in a global bull market for equities. If you take a look at the Rambus technical analysis, the message is very clear. The bull market is still on. And it's not just technical analysis. My fundamental analysis says the planet equity bull that I've talked about since 2014 is still on. Particularly, if anything's going to drive this, it's continued growth in Asia and the integration between Europe and Asia along the Silk Road. There is a push globally to securitize everything, and we have lots more to go, including real estate, as I described in the third quarter wrap-up last year, megacities. Risk is definitely rising. We have trade wars. We have a breakdown of international trade agreements and system. We have a slowing of globalization, which means many companies and governments are choking on their debt. We have falling productivity for a variety of reasons. And of course, we have the politics of peak everything, and part of that is playing out as concern over the environment. And so there's a lot of friction in the global economy and global relationships. The $64,000 question for me is, how fast and when can they bring the energy price down? Whether it's lower cost of renewables, cold fusion, wireless recharging, other kinds of technologies. So we really have a race between peak everything and the successful application of new technology. And depending on how that goes, things could turn positive or extremely ugly. Point number two, the bull market has been the beneficiary of falling interest rates and rising levels of sovereign debt, and central banking, bond, and stock buying, as one of the GATA folks once said, there are no markets, just interventions. And the interventions to keep the bull market going are quite significant. We now have $15 trillion of negative interest rates. We see the Bank of England come out and say, no, they don't believe in negative interest rates. And part of that is to handle very high debt levels that, as I said, are being pinched by the slowing trade and the structural changes. And part of what's being digested is the rebalancing of the U.S.-China relationship, which had to happen. But it very much kept a false prosperity going in the U.S. And it means a lot of companies are going to have to re-engineer global supply lines because the national security issues between the two blocks are very, very significant. And of course, the Anglo-American alliance is re-engineering, whether it's Make America Great Again or Brexit. It's all part of sort of a move, and that's a sort of tearing apart between Europe and the Anglo-American alliance. We see warnings today about the trade tensions between Europe and the United States, and that's really Europe and the Anglo-American alliance, the danger of that really coming apart, and real tensions in the among the central banking community about the extent to which the central banks are taking interest rates negative and buying equities. You know, if the central banks keep buying equities, the question is, will they buy the whole planet? It's one way to keep planet equity not only going, but overwhelming everything. Point number three, the U.S. stock market continues to outperform Europe, Asia, and global markets. Since the low point in 2009, as shown in the chart in the commentary this week, the S&P is up 309%, the NASDAQ up over 400%, Europe's only up 108%, China up 82%. Respectable returns, but nothing like the U.S. Now, point number four, that outperformance of the U.S. stock market has been primarily a large company phenomena. If you look at any measures of S&P as a percent of GNP or PE ratios, it's quite high. Let me just read something from the GMO second quarter letter, which, again, I recommend very strongly. If you will accept a little oversimplification, the last decade or so of global equity market performance can be summarized as follows. U.S. stocks have profoundly outperformed stocks in the rest of the world, whether other developed markets or emerging markets. This outperformance has been partially driven by U.S. PE ratios expanding more than in other markets. But the largest driver of the outperformance has been the massive superiority of earnings growth in the U.S. relative to anywhere else. This superior earnings growth has been driven not so much by strong top-line growth, but by expanding profitability by U.S. companies relative to sales, gross profits, or other measures that can plausibly be used as proxies for economic capital. Unlike in past cycles, this rising profitability seems to have been neither a result of nor a driver of increased corporate investment. Digging a little deeper, we can see that the improvement in profitability has occurred only in the largest companies. These companies have been out-earning their smaller brethren by increasing margins over the past 25 years or so. The long period of their improvement suggests this effect is not something we should expect to correct over a single business cycle. But my guess is that the world in the future will be less favorable to these large dominant companies than is true of the current environment. If we were to adjust the assumptions of margin reversion in our forecast to account for a slower pace of this reversion, our forecast for U.S. large cap stocks, as well as high quality stocks, would improve noticeably. But the adjustment would still leave them looking meaningfully worse than the other groups of equities we forecast. Translated, what he's saying is trouble ahead for U.S. large caps. So here's what The Economist said last year in November 2018. Quote, since 1997, market concentration has risen in two-thirds of American industries. A tenth of the economy is made up of industries in which four firms control more than two-thirds of the market. In a healthy economy, you would expect profits to be competed down. But the free cash flow of companies is 76% above its 50-year average relative to GDP. In Europe, the trend is similar, if less extreme. The average market share of the biggest four firms in each industry has risen by 3 percentage points since 2000. On both continents, dominant firms have become harder to dislodge. Incumbents scoff at the idea that they have it easy. However consolidated markets become domestically, they argue, globalization keeps heating the furnace of competition. But in industries that are less exposed to trade, firms are making huge returns. We calculate the global pool of abnormal profits to be $660 billion, more than two-thirds of which is made in America, one-third of that in technology firms. Okay, so that's huge. Let me just read it again. We calculate the global pool of abnormal profits to be $660 billion, more than two-thirds of which is made in America, one-third of that in technology firms. Now, one of the things you've been hearing me talk a lot about since I started the Solari Report is centralization. That is the price of uneconomic centralization. Point number five, these large U.S. companies have been the beneficiary of astonishing levels of U.S. government support and largesse. They don't call it the military-industrial complex for nothing. Whether it's contracts, whether it's purchases, whether it's favorable tax treatment, whether it's the huge support of the NSA and intelligence agency interdependency with the telecoms and the social media firms and the tech firms, all of which Snowden and Bill Binney and Tom Drake have described, you know, fantastically. I don't need to repeat it here. And that's before we talk about the bailouts, $21 trillion of missing money, and now FASB 56. How much largesse does it take? If the European stock market is up 100% and the U.S. stock market is up 300% and the NASDAQ's up 400%, how much of that came from that largesse from the transfer of technology and other goodies through the black budget? You know, your guess is as good as mine, but I suspect it's huge. Point number six. Those large U.S. companies are facing a perfect storm of opposition. First and foremost, as we get slowing globally, there's no doubt large companies are running into far more headwinds globally, and it's one of the reasons they're trying to push harder and dive deeper in the U.S. and sort of home-based markets. There is extraordinary political pushback to inequality and environmental problems and all sorts of other sort of externalities. A lot of those are more a result of negative returns on government money that show up as corporate profits. But I would say the big problem is in the government side, and that's where you have to fix it. But of course, we're not getting that. We're getting wacky proposals reflecting real legitimate anger, but from people who don't understand and haven't been able to bluntly say what they're concerned about is criminal enterprise by both government and corporations. You know, they say they're against capitalism, but we're not, you don't get monopolies from capitalism. These monopolies are not the product of capitalist behavior in capitalist markets. I always tell people I would love to try capitalism. Okay, so you have more competition, you have political pushback, now you've got finally the antitrust establishment is waking up, both in America and in Europe, and you have real taxation pushes against social media and tech. So on both sides of the Atlantic, real antitrust and taxation issues. And of course, as the trade war heats up with China, then you're getting pushback on tech from China as well. And to all Americans, there's a, you know, the national security is spilling into all of the corporate businesses. Technocracy is being marketed under the guise of climate change, and it's running into highly intelligent networks in small business, in professionals, small farms. The BS is boomeranging, and some of that boomeranging is going after the big companies who are kind of supporting and promoting the BS. There are a significant number of productive professionals and farmers and business people all around the world, and they're having breakthroughs with regards to how bad the fake news, the fake science, the fake medical advice is, and the trust in the system is shifting, and that can work against the large corporations, even if they're you know, in theory, even if they're not guilty of it. Finally, you're seeing real difficulty operating against political fault lines, whether it's trade wars or real national security issues. This is happening between the United States and China, but the political fault lines are going to get trickier and trickier to compete across, and it's going to make it much harder for the large firms to get the benefits they've had. Sort of, they've had the wind at their back over the last 20 years, and some of that, you know, sort of that positive good fortune is turning into well-deserved pushback. Okay, point number 7. Payback is coming in sectors that have carried the U.S. outperformance. So let's look at a couple sectors. We've had healthcare companies making glorious profits, and yet if you look at any measure of healthcare performance in the United States, it absolutely stinks. Now, I'm not going to blame it all on healthcare companies, but this is not a productive system. So the United States is now spending, as of 2017, over $10,000 per person. That is significantly greater than the next largest, which is Switzerland, which is spending $8,000 per person. And I assure you, if you've spent any time in Switzerland, the Swiss are much healthier than we are. Germany spends $5,700 per person. The Netherlands, where I am today, spends $5,400 per person. So if you look at comparable wealthy countries, they're about, on average, $5,300. France is $4,900. Canada, $4,800. So we're talking about extraordinary expenditures on a per-person basis. Now, if you look at health expenditures, a percentage of gross domestic product, it's the same thing, of course. We're spending about 17% on gross domestic product on healthcare. Switzerland, 12%, Germany, 11%, and then down from there in the wealthy countries. And I would say that if you look at how much we're spending versus the performance, you know, this is criminal. And you can take a deep dive into certain examples. So, for example, we saw legislation pass a vaccine compensation fund so that any vaccine injury got paid by essentially a fee on all vaccines paid by the people receiving the vaccines. As soon as that fund got put into place and the pharmaceutical companies were free of liability, suddenly the lobbying and the pushing for heavy schedules of mandated vaccines became extraordinary. And we see the insurance companies engineer bonuses for doctors so that literally doctors are firing patients who won't get the recommended vaccinations. And so the tactics to force people to get vaccinated is extraordinary. And the FDA gets cut in for a percent of the profits because they're getting paid on patents on vaccines. So the whole thing is, you know, if you look at the harm being done to people to get a pharmaceutical company stock price up a little bit more, it's absolutely, you know, Rappaport calls it Hotel Auschwitz, and he's being kind. You know, add to that the suppression of natural cures for cancer. And again, we're seeing a pharmaceutical and healthcare industry, which is really getting into a very severe win-lose relationship with people, and people are beginning to understand the extent to which, and it's hard for many people to fathom that could be this evil, but you know that tsunami is coming. Another great example is the financials. If you sit down and look at what has been going on over the last 20 years, we've watched the financial industry work with Washington and state government to change the laws. So anything, what used to be illegal because it was usury, has been made legal. So we're seeing interest rates charged, which are usurious. We're seeing consumer protections stripped. You know, the perfect example is not permitting students to, with student loan problems, to go bankrupt or extinguish their loans in bankruptcy. So you're basically taking what used to be sort of the way the mob did it, and you're making it legal. And it's astonishing that we've gotten used to living with legalized usury. this should all be illegal. But let's take a look at part of how the slow burn is being used and used to squeeze people. You know, the average American is getting on their savings on their CD or bank deposit. They're not getting 8% or more the way they used to. They're getting 0 to 2%. So if I'm earning 0 to 2% on my savings, then the average American credit card is paying 15 to 17% in interest. So the bank can borrow at the Fed windows for 0 to 2%. And meantime, the average taxpayer, now they can borrow at those cheap rates because they're being supported with taxpayer credit. But meantime, the taxpayers are supporting them with a credit are then having to borrow that 0 to 2% money at 15 to 17%. Thank you, Joe Biden. Joe Biden, being in Delaware, is one of his biggest supporters of the credit card companies. Anyway, so I'm earning 2% of my savings, but then I'm paying 15 to 17% of my credit card. Now, I'm also getting 8 to 12%, if you trust the Chapwood Index, which I do, in regular rising prices in household goods. So again, I'm earning 0 to 2% of my savings. I'm paying 15 to 17% of my credit card, and now my household goods are going up at 8 to 12%. And my income increase, if you believe the sort of government statistics, my income is maybe going up 4%. So if I'm making 2% on my savings and 4% on my income, but my real inflation is 8 to 12%, and I'm paying 15 to 17% on my credit card, it doesn't take you long to realize I'm slowly getting squeezed into the ground. Now you add to that the bailouts, the missing money, now negative interest rates, you know, and we see where this goes. It goes into a deep, slow burn. It's like a financial vampire. And it's all been made legal, but it shouldn't be. Traditionally, this kind of usury has been illegal and should be returned to that. Between bailouts and usury, the rigged game in America, and the invisible financial arbitrage between my cost of capital and the large cap company cost of capital is basically it's an engineered slow burn that's ultimately going to destroy a significant number of people in the middle class. Let's look at tech. As I said, we've got antitrust federal investigations. We've got state AG investigations. We have European proposals on taxation and state proposals on taxation. But some of that reflects the fact that you have increased consumer understanding of surveillance capitalism. The real problem is the sort of private-public partnership between the U.S. intelligence agencies and the Five Eyes system and the big corporations, as well as sort of the technology transfer going on behind the scenes. But I think it's fair to say that the general population, the bloom is off the rose in terms of the free ride the tech companies have been getting. Energy, of course, we see climate change really moving to target the oil and gas sector. What's been interesting in the oil and gas sector is part of the challenge is the politics of the extent to which the dollar is on an oil standard. But I've been getting for the last 2 years constant feedback from the oil patch that in the fracking world, we're spending $2 to get a dollar's worth of oil or gas. And the question is, why? Why such a, you know, it's the equivalent on the asset side of the balance sheet of negative interest rates. So it's, you know, you're throwing helicopter money at trying to turn the U.S. into looking like it's self-sufficient on energy. And as I said, the big question is, when do we drop the energy price from new technology, whether it's from dropping renewable prices or breakthrough technology like cold fusion? To me, this is one of the biggest wild cards in the economy. We see major rollovers next year of the oil and gas debt that can't possibly get paid from fundamental economics in the industry. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that gets sorted out. The other thing is, if you look at the move to take advantage of what I call the place-based opportunity, the reality is the way to make money on dropping energy prices is on the real estate values. And so it's probably why there's so much interest top down in real estate, whether it's coming through disaster capitalism or getting the millennials to buy housing. Okay, so healthcare has carried the U.S. stock market. That's facing serious headwinds for good reason. Tech has been carrying the market. As I said, the NASDAQ more than 100% more in terms of performance than the S&P. That's running into serious headwinds. Energy, which is important throughout the economy, is running into serious headwinds. So now let's turn to buybacks. One of the reasons that the U.S. market has done so well is we poured tremendous money into buying stock back. You know, so you got the central banks buying, and then you've got the companies buying themselves back. It's really diminished the float in the markets. It's a way of leveraging the balance sheet, and it just can't go on forever, particularly if you look at what's coming in the corporate bond markets. So there's lots of different headwinds in a lot of different sectors. And the question is, you know, if you were going to posit that the U.S. market could continue strong, where's the earnings going to come from? Okay, so point number eight, never underestimate the power of the political class to deliver steroids to monopolies. One of the things that really made me laugh about Grantham, because Grantham's firm has one of my favorite commentators on investment, James Montier. Grantham and Montier just couldn't believe that the U.S. market could continue to go up, and for years they were kept shaking their heads. And finally, Grantham wrote a piece a year or two ago, finally saying the equivalent, these are my words, not his, you know, I underestimated the power of the American political class to deliver steroids to monopolies. Anyway, earlier this year, he said in an interview on one of the networks, when somebody said to him, well, couldn't the U.S. market go up more? He said, you can't get blood out of a stone. No, but if you have sufficiently invisible weapons and systems, you know, vampires can steal it out of living things. So I covered this extensively last quarter. I covered all the different ways the Trump administration could get the stock market. They clearly want to get it over 30,000. That's one of their internal targets. So let's look at some of those things again. One is, if you look at FASB 56 and the related classification waivers combined with transnational organized crime, you know, don't think that the border, part of the border fight isn't a fight over who controls those cash flows. If you look at the funny business that would go down with the Green New Deal, and privatization might be a concern, is after the election we're going to see some pretty significant privatization out of the federal government. There's a new one, and I've brought it up and posted a link to it. Secretary Mnuchin has come forward with a proposal to privatize Freddie and Fannie, which is about the worst thing I've ever seen. I thought FASB 56 was the worst thing I'd ever seen. But if you combine FASB 56 with this, it's just unbelievable. What he's saying, we have to wait to see what the legislative language is, what he's proposing to do is to make Freddie and Fannie totally private. That means they're not subject to FOIA, and then basically allow them to issue full faith and credit debt to finance mortgages, which means they are going to be able to sell in here infinite amount of paper, take the money, and keep it entirely secret what they do with that. They're not subject to FOIA. So now we're talking, you know, with FASB 56, the money still has to go through the Treasury or some kind of government bureaucracy or DOD. Now it's just totally private. And the way they've described the issuance of this ability to issue basically taxpayer credit that you and I are liable for, if you're an American, is they're going to offer this to other firms as well. So let's see if the White House approves it and what the final language to Congress is. But I suspect we're talking about the mother of all steroids here. FASB 56 in combination with mortgage fraud to the moon, all done on a private basis. Now, the Fed just came out at the end of September with a directive on appraisals that said it could buy paper that basically mortgage-backed paper with no appraisals were required up to $400,000. So I suspect what we're going to see is a system between Freddie and Fannie and the Fed where the money is going to roll out, particularly in the first-time home buyer. What we're talking about is a land rush to take advantage of the place-based opportunity, which is enormous. And I think it's one of the reasons you're seeing the rush to override local regulations related to the 5G towers, because they want to get all those towers out there for the Internet of Things. That's part of taking technocracy the last mile. If you haven't heard the Solera report I did with Patrick Wood on technocracy and opportunity zones, I strongly recommend that you listen to that as very important background for what is going on in America. And if it's going on in America, it's probably going to be rolling out different versions of it everywhere. They're taking technocracy the last mile means the Internet of Things and getting really invasive into homes and into communities, both federal infrastructure investment, but we're also going to see plenty of disaster capitalism. I think we're seeing lots of disaster capitalism going after the farmland in this country. This year is the year when the millennial generation is expected to be larger than the boomer generation. So it's going to be the dominant generation from here on out. And it's a perfect time, if you're the administration, to start pushing money out to the millennials for first-time home buyers. And that would be coordinating with the 2020 elections. If you can get all the millennials to buy homes and form households, that's going to be a huge part of building the Internet of Things out in places and lifting the sort of whole real estate opportunity. If you look at the charts on the stock market currently, two of the sectors that are doing very well is real estate and home builder. And I suspect one of the reasons is they can see this coming. And certainly the expectation is we're going to get a major pump coming into the 2020 election. So watch closely to see how the first-time home buying market develops between now and the end of the elections, because I'm looking for a big financial wave and boom to take technocracy that last mile. And if a wave of mortgage money and low interest rates combines with 5G and the Internet of Things, and that ultimately combines with a lower energy price, we're going to see an incredible boom on the sort of in the local markets. Okay, so point number 9, do you want the U.S. stock market to go up? You know, it's funny, I get a lot of calls from people saying, you know, I'm really worried about my portfolio and I really want my portfolio to go up. The U.S. current stock market is at, depending on how you count it, 140 to 170% of GDP, which is about it's at or above the 2000 bubble high. The PE is 21 times, and that's down from 24 times. It's hit that repeated years in the last 4 years, but it's still fairly high. It was at about 13 times at the beginning of this bull market. So if you look at the market returning to any reasonable level of market to GDP, you're going to be getting negative returns in the U.S. stock market. And that's what GMO was describing in their second quarter newsletter. Now, here's the problem, particularly with the large cap stocks. The current model between corporations and people is win-lose. And if you look at all the proposals floating around in the campaign, all they're going to do is change it to a lose-lose. I'm not sure which is worse, a win-lose relationship or a lose-lose relationship. many of the people who've been, you know, sort of saying that the market was going to crash for years, part of what they were saying is they're hoping that the market drop would then somehow return us back to a win-win model after the crazy, wacky economics got sorted out. I just don't see that happening because I think the problems are not they're not temporary. They're much deeper and systematic than a market crash is going to correct, particularly because in that kind of environment, the psychopaths are going to have the cash and the liquidity and the weapons, and the general population is going to be at a greater disadvantage. Hence my focus on FASB 56 and now the proposal for the privatization of Freddie and Fannie, because it's creating a model where there are absolutely no markets. There's just the printing of fantastic amounts of money in, you know, in agencies and companies that can keep everything secret and using it to squeeze politically from the top. Another next step, of course, is privatizing more of the federal government. And then it's going to come deeper, privatizing your state government and municipality. Once you get the Internet of Things rolled out, that's going to be the next step, is coming in and turning your municipality into a corporate entity. And I hate to say this, as long as they can print, they can keep on coming. As long as we're in a win-lose model, a rising U.S. stock market is bad for most people. I don't care how much money you have in U.S. stocks. If you look at the negativity happening society-wide by the large caps U.S. stocks doing better and better, we've reached a point where increased rises in the large cap stocks in the U.S. are bad for productivity, they're bad for society, and ultimately, long run, I think they're going to be very bad for people in the economy. We have a recent survey of CEOs who said they're not, U.S. CEOs, said they're not optimistic about the future. I can certainly appreciate why. We have too many factions fighting over who's going to use the federal credit to centralize, but no indication that there's significant willingness to shift to a win-win model. And I think anybody I've heard or read from the corporations on ESG or socially responsible investment absolutely fails to deal with the reality of the military-industrial organized crime complex, which is what we're going to have to deal with if we're going to deal with real issues of getting to a win-win model. Okay, so point number 10, where is the opportunity? I don't know when the large caps hit the skids. I don't underestimate the ability of the U.S. political class to deliver steroids. But, you know, there are kind of two strategies of dealing with it. One newsletter writer I like is Richard Mayberry's strategy, and he's not interested in the karma problem. He just says the world's, you know, everybody's going to get afraid of being killed, so buy gold and defense contractors. My strategy is different. I just don't buy into that. I've seen too many companies choke ultimately on the win-lose risk issues. And yes, I appreciate that the U.S. dollar reserve currency and the government can protect some of those companies for a long, long time. But a lot of times the problem comes back to bite you. What happened to Monsanto is a great example of that, which I'm, in fact, writing in a different piece about that now. I'll never forget looking at my uncle's portfolio once upon a time and realizing how much money he'd made on Green Mountain Coffee. It was one of the best performing stocks for one or two decades in the U.S. stock market. And it's a perfect example of a company that figured out some pretty useful things and made a fortune for investors. There are lots of companies like that around. Anyway, so my strategy is sticking with value. Precious metals continues to perform well. There's a great roundup on what precious metals has been doing in the Rambus Chartology. As I said, he looked at global stock markets and precious metals. Equities is still in a bull market, but the internal mixes within the market are going to change, and it's not going to change in favor of the U.S. is what I believe. you're going to see small caps and value stocks in the U.S. There are going to be good companies that successfully apply technology. In the foreign developed markets, you have many markets trading at a much lower market to GDP ratio than the U.S. If you take a look at that guru focus, you can see who those markets are. And there are many great stocks that are now available in those markets, especially as the brokers move out to try and bring in the global markets. And they're trading at lower PEs. So if you look at the dollar of earnings or a dollar of dividend that you can buy in some pretty fine markets, it's much more attractive. And then, of course, Asia, if you look at the GDP growth in Asia, that's where the real growth is coming from. But I would be careful to avoid the national security issues. Areas of particular interest to me, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity to buy dividends in global real estate and some capital gains too, especially, again, if we make progress on the energy price. I'm always very interested in food, and you can see a table press of the food, publicly traded food stocks in the U.S. in the Global Harvest wrap-up. But I've found it very difficult to find listed companies in this sector that I like. I think it will be increasingly important sector, but you may have to go to direct ownership or find good private managers if you want to do more, particularly in land in this area. But there's no doubt, I think there's a land rush on to get good farmland with good water. The area where I think you're going to get the best returns is the application of tech and very innovative application, whether it's building homes with 3D printing or, you know, applying all sorts of, for example, robotics to grow organic food and make it much more economic. When I look for companies all around the world, whenever I'm traveling, wherever I am, I'm looking for companies. I find excellent companies with low debt. They're not heavily dependent on government contracts or purchases. They contribute to productivity, but they don't get a lot of attention. There are thousands of them and thousands of hardworking people trying to make things go. But if you're going to invest in those companies, they haven't been the companies that have had the momentum because they haven't had the huge influx of government subsidy and support. So if you're going to pick them out and invest, you need to stop worrying about the index and focus on enduring dividends. It also means you absolutely have to be global, because right now there's just more available. If you look at the PEs, if you look at the market to GDP, there's more available in Europe, Asia, even some in Latin America. But again, I'm concerned about the emerging markets gaining the growth and productivity that we see in Asia. Take a look at the Guru Focus article. It's called Global Stock Market Valuations and Expected Future Returns. The link are in the subscriber links, but it'll give you a good sense of what I'm talking about. If you were going to get on a space shuttle and go to Mars for 20 years, take a look at that and say, okay, where would I put my money today? You need to think really long term about this. So my message is, on all these key points, get back to basics. Good companies, low debt, good dividend growth. Apply technology. That's where a lot of the added value is going to be, particularly if we can reduce the energy price. If you want to stay in U.S. large cap, some people do because they have a low cost basis. They don't want to pay taxes. They're getting a great dividend. Get hedged. Stay hedged. I just think if things go the wrong way, we could take a very big drop. Now, there's no doubt that anybody who's been hedged for the last 5 years has paid a very heavy price to stay hedged. But given where large caps are, I think it's I think the market is very, very high relative to what you could do elsewhere. Finally, go global. Look at market value to GDP. There are lots of great markets around the world with lots of great companies doing very good things. Okay, so those are my 10 key points. Let's talk about special risk issues. There are plenty of risk issues. Risk is absolutely rising. That's what happens when you have accelerating change. So central banks are now getting so you've got monetary largesse that's really turning into fiscal stimulus, particularly because it's financing governments that have no market for their paper other than central banks. And that's scary. We have clearly the reserve currency under stress, and with that, the global military comp model under stress. The economics of the global military is bankrupting the empire, and the question is, how's that going to sort out? We had a very interesting speech by the Attorney General William Barr at the Notre Dame Law School, and he talked about the organized assault on values. All economies, all financial systems depend on trust. And trust depends on virtue. It depends on people keeping their contracts and people obeying the laws. And the problem with transnational organized crime rising to the size and shape it is and intertwining with governments in the blatant way that it is now is really causing a tremendous deterioration in values. And if you're the Attorney General, you quickly realize you can't make up with enforcement for a culture that has no lawfulness as its practice in daily life. The 800-pound gorilla in the room is a combination of FASB 56 and now the proposal on Freddie and Fannie and what they may do in the mortgage market. I don't think Attorney General apparently realizes that you can't have a virtuous society when the money is unsound to this extent. So debasing the currency and debasing the federal credit mechanism is ultimately has, by definition, is going to lead to a debased culture. We have a race to the bottom in the U.S. brokerage system. It doesn't give me a lot of confidence in the brokers who've all now gone to essentially free commissions. It's interesting to see that we see Patrick Byrne, the CEO of Overstock, who'd done such incredible work on describing the corruption in the financial mechanisms in terms of naked short selling. He and his partners had a website, Deep Capture, about that. I think you can still see it on the web. He cashed out and walked out of Overstock, and it wouldn't surprise me if that was one of the reasons. I'm sure he's concerned about the stability of the system. I'm exceptionally worried about the harvest this year. I think we have an unsettled food supply, and the environmental issues, whatever their cause, whether they're man-made from global spraying, et cetera, and nuclear testing and all the other ills that befall us, whether it's coming from just geophysical changes, you know, whatever the nature of the situation, most people are invariably better off investing in creating our own food supply or associating with farmers and other sources that can provide us our food supply. That's a better investment today than trying to chase yields in global stock markets. So whatever you need to do to lock up your long-term food supply, a food supply that's natural, fresh. I mean, I know more than a few people are investing in farmers to make sure they have that food supply. So again, that's a much better investment long-term than chasing yields in the markets. So think about the harvest and think about your food supply and keep working to develop a very high quality food supply. Market pushback. We're seeing all sorts of stocks or companies not make it to the IPO market. The market's not buying their story, which is a good sign. It's getting much more discerning. So we see Theranos go down from pressure from and writing from the Wall Street Journal. We see Aramco on the shelf. That's an IPO that's not going to make it, which is going to really squeeze Saudi Arabia. We see WeWork not make it into the IPO market. And finally, the CEO have to leave. So the market's pushing back, and that's a good sign. And finally, there is pushback all around the world. You have large number of highly intelligent, hardworking people who want to be productive, and they don't like technocracy, and they don't like win-lose corporate models, and they don't like transnational organized crime, and they're starting to figure things out. And so with a very deeply intelligent pushback, it's one of the reasons I want companies that I call are low to the ground. They add fundamental productivity. They have a healthy future because they're in a win-win relationship with their employees, with the people they serve, with the communities they function in. And so they may not have the glorious minimum, and they may not have huge subsidy, but when, as that pushback develops, they're going to be able to endure, particularly if they have low debt and clean balance sheets. Anyway, for that to work, for them to attract the support they need, we need transparency in markets. And unfortunately, the U.S. is heading in the opposite direction, which is why I keep banging the drum about the dangers of taking securities markets dark and large pots of money dark. So whether it's the U.S. government going dark or Harvard going dark, it's a big, big impediment to making the positive changes we need to go. Because if you can't, unfortunately, if you can't get the corporate model converted to a win-win relationship, the dangers politically of a lose-lose happening are much higher. So all these risks make people nervous about investment in the market. However, my whole read is planet equity is on. If it's not on in the U.S., then it's certainly on in Asia around the world. Get out to Asia and check out what's going on. A great deal of the world's business is done by companies, and there are thousands of good companies, and they're out there doing a good job. They're a sound investment in the future. Never let the mobster stand between us and the future, because the future's going to happen, and it's out there. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, those are my thoughts for the third quarter equity overview. Please check out the web presentation for the charts and the Rambus Blockbuster Chartology. The subscriber links will be in the commentary at the homepage. And again, I've listed out for you some of what I think is the best analysis available on the economy and equity markets. These are people who do a tremendous amount of analytics, and they've done a very good job just sort of cutting through and getting to the key things you need to understand what's going on. So, in closing, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. The outperformance of the U.S. large cap, in my book, proves beyond any shadow of a doubt that there's definitely a conspiracy. But here's the thing, if you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. So, ladies and gentlemen, good night, good hunting, and good luck.